Thank you. Welcome back to Coast AM. And it always amazes me. I pick these bumper music at the beginning of the show, but I'm just stunned how accurate the lyrics of the song are in regards to what we're talking about. Now, we're on with Daniel Pinchbeck, and his website is danielpinchbeck.net. And Daniel, we were talking about the look of the future, how things are going to be playing out, and what influences are driving some of these big changes. And of course, the internet comes to mind. There's been a lot of talk lately about controlling the internet and these corporations taking it over, and you have to pay for access. So what's the latest on that?
I think that more and more people are recognizing that the internet's kind of like, past a little bit of a tipping point. For a number of years, it seemed like this tremendous technology of liberation and social change and so on. I think it's a kind of it's a process, where sometimes it often happens. There's kind of liberational upsurges. And then the dominant system figures out how to kind of integrate them or use them to a certain extent. I think we saw that a lot in the 60s, with the kind of social movements, the psychedelic movement, the sexual liberation movement, in ways that those movements were kind of co-opted, over time. So now we've reached this point where people really are aware that, like, Facebook and Google and so on are not really the friends they were meant to be. I mean, Google used to have a slogan, "Do no evil." They actually had to kind of rescind that slogan or use it anymore, because they've been so meshed in this whole, like, corporate system and everything. So the question is, like, is there a next stage? Is there another way that the internet can be used positively for these progressive goals, social goals, reducing global inequality, kind of healing the planet ecologically. And I think there's a lot of reasons to think that, the social media and the social technology could play a crucial role in this transition. If we look at the history of political economic systems connected, they're always connected to media. So for instance, we would never have had empire like Rome or Babylon, without a written code of laws and an accounting system, so that a certain level of, standards could be applied over a large scale. We would never have had the modern nation state, liberal democracy, representational democracy, without the printing press that created, allowed for mass literacy, and therefore allowed, for more people to participate in the democratic process or the representational process. So the internet now points towards the potential for a whole new way that society could be organized, a way that would be more cooperative, more collective, and more participatory. In a sense, like, we're stuck at the moment with a government that is kind of like 19th century social technology. Essentially, our government was created at a time when horse and buggies and schooner ships were the fastest means for transferring information and ideas. I mean, now with the internet, ideas can be transferred immediately, and the government was kind of, in a way, designed to sort of slow things down. We're dealing with a 19th century kind of technology, and we're dealing with 21st century problems that are quick, that require immediate attention, that require kind of faster capacities for decision-making on a large scale than the governments and supranational organizations seem capable of doing. So the question is, could the internet provide kind of a framework or a infrastructure for a kind of rapid, kind of symbiotic evolution to kind of new forms of decision-making, new structures of new forms of social organizing? That would allow, for instance, human, kind of a ma you know kind of a civil society movement where people were, more directly engaged with all the types of changes that we now see are urgently necessary. So all of that really interests me, and particularly I've been looking at recently with Center for Planetary Culture. We're looking at applying a set of standard and protocols developed by the Respect Network, which is just launching this month. The Respect Network is a 10-year effort to develop a philosophical, legal, and technical framework for taking a new approach to online identity. From the Respect Network's perspective, they want to create a form of secure, portable identity where, you know, you're no longer kind of data mined and controlled or captured by these different corporations and organizations, and instead you have a secure holder of your own personal information and data, and you actually choose how you interact, what information you share with any corporation, with any organization, and actually you yourself will be able to monetize your own data rather than being, you know, allowed for corporations just to turn you into their products.
Yeah, I think a lot of people feel that way, especially when they agree to the terms and conditions of almost any website they interact with. It's like giving a little piece of yourself away every time you do it.
Yeah, so the potential is to create like another kind of technical protocol or level in a way that would really address that problem fundamentally, and then might also help for these kind of alternative possibilities to emerge quicker.
Well, great. We'll keep it right there. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about more about net neutrality and net equality and much more. Our guest is Daniel Pinchbeck. You're on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. We're talking with Daniel Pinchbeck, and I want to ask you about net equality. I mean, in China, they don't have Facebook. Everything's censored. There's no access to the deep web just about anywhere. These big search engines don't even touch it. And now we hear these big cable companies trying to buy preferred access to a large chunk of the internet, leaving the average user out of the fast lane. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I don't think they're good developments. You know, I mean, once again, I mean, so you know, I want to go back to my earlier idea that I presented, that we could look at humanity, you know, as a whole, coming to a realization of ourselves as a single planetary superorganism that's in a symbiotic relationship to the ecology as a whole. Now, and we can look at past epochs of evolution where we shifted from competitive, dominator, aggressive, you know, behavior and species to cooperative, symbiotic, collaborative modes. Now, an idea that I think is really fascinating is that corporations in themselves, you know, which we often see as destructive or negative or whatever, might actually be kind of the nascent organs in this collective body of humanity that's developing right now.
How so?
So if we look at a corporation like an energy company, it's essentially like the blood, you know, the heart circulatory system that's moving energy through the system, like in a human body. If we look at the media, it's like the perceptual mechanisms, you know, the cognitive functions and so on, which are taking in data and transmitting that, you know, to the whole organism, so the organism knows how to act. You know, so in a sense, but the problem is that at the time being, once again, we can look at corporations as, in a sense, like artificial life forms, right? Like, we constructed corporations, they're human constructions, we constructed them out of, you know, data, out of legal code, out of brand insignia, out of ideas, you know, innovations and so on. But we took these artificial life forms, we injected them into a kind of game machinery that we call the stock market, right? And, you know, what the stock market is basically these artificial life forms that we've created now have to, you know, fight for survival. And the way they do that is by maximizing shareholder value. So we created these corporations as artificial life forms, and we gave them just one prime directive, which is to maximize shareholder value, which means to increase profit. So if you look at it from that way, you can't really even blame corporations for a lot of what they do. You know, I mean, you can blame the people involved in them, I suppose. But, you know, if you think about like the you know, BP, British Petroleum, and the Gulf oil spill, you know, if a corporation is an artificial life form and we've given it one prime directive to maximize shareholder value, then of course that entity has to undermine kind of ecological restrictions, you know, hire lobbyists if that's the cheapest way to maximize shareholder value, et cetera. So I think once again, we need to, you know, rather than getting so hooked into these questions of, oh no, these telecom companies and all this terrible stuff that's happening, we first need to have the right level of understanding and analysis of the whole system. And we have to recognize where the system, you know, is failing us. And that also, you know, these systems are just things that humans have created and innovated, and they've developed out of their own inertia and grown over time. We actually have that opportunity, that ability to take conscious mastery of the situation and change their direction. I really like Barbara Marx Hubbard, who talks about it in terms of conscious evolution. And as a species, we're moving from kind of, you know, the inertia of these old habits, you know, our kind of ossified belief systems, to awakening, you know, to our capacity to direct creatively our own evolution, you know, socially, even biologically, culturally, and so on. So we then need to look at our culture and our social system as, as something that we can reinvent, you know, so that it supports healthy behavior, healthy practices for everybody.
You talk about the need for a new mythology. And in this world of exponential growth and technology and, you know, our ecosystem just exploding and our natural resources just disappearing, can you give us an example of what this new mythology would look like?
Right. So I think, I mean, I think it's a super important thing. I mean, we're trapped in this worldview, which I don't even, you know, it's that we've had for, you know, a few hundred years. That's basically this idea that only things that have value that are measurable and quantifiable. So you have a GDP, you know, and the health of a country is based on the gross domestic product, which is actually an insane calculus, right? Because we now know the GDP is simply based on all of the transactions in an economy over a year, right? So if you think about that, like, what creates the most transactions is not always the best thing. You know, if you have a corporate lawyer who is going through a messy divorce and also has terminal cancer, that person is creating huge amounts of economic transactions. He's a great boon to the GDP, but his quality of life sucks, and all those economic transactions are in a sense negatives. You know, so we look at it that way. We have to shift from this idea of purely economic material kind of exchanges as having value. And we have to think more in terms of qualitative, interpersonal, relational, experiential, as those become kind of the basis for this new paradigm and worldview.
Hmm.
You know? Now, in terms of this, I think, and also we kind of need to chart a positive direction because, you know, I think in a way we've had this myth of progress and of technology, you know, having this certain role, you know, and as we see that deterioration, you know, of our civilizational model, we then have to think about, well, where are we going? You know, and I like to think that we could be going two directions, right? The one of them is literally up and out, to other worlds, to settle other planets. And the other one would be down and in. And that second route is into kind of the infinite depths of the psychocosmos. You know, these endless, super subtle dimensions of consciousness that one experiences through meditation, through mystical experience, through shamanism, and so on. I think there's a vast domain of uncharted territory that humanity is just on the cusp of accessing and exploring.
Mm, indeed.
And when we look at the other way, which is up and out, I mean, I really love the work of Lynn Margolis, who wrote the book Microcosmos,
yeah,
and was married to Carl Sagan. And she was one of the developers of the Gaia hypothesis, which posits that the Earth itself is like a vast living organism and has an intelligence to it. So from that perspective, she thinks about our evolution of technology as an aspect of this whole Gaian matrix, right? Like, in a way, technology seems to be something that's just working through us. Like, we have some control over it, but it's also just happening, you know? So her idea is that the Gaian intelligence of the planet is auditioning humans to be the kind of agents of the Gaia sphere's reproduction, that we have this opportunity to be the carriers through our technologies, through spaceships, through you know, being able to bioregenerate, you know, atmospheres on other planets. We could be the ones who bring the living biosphere of the Earth, across this solar system and then beyond.
Mm.
So that's one possible trajectory for humanity. I'd say that would be part of kind of this new mythology, would be seeing that, we could actually be going on to great adventures on other worlds while we fully explore the depths of our infinite potential in terms of our own consciousness.
Mm. Well, if this new mythology that you talk about is growing out of this advancing technological age, then what would Julian Assange be? What character would he be in ancient Greek mythology? What would his counterpart be?
In ancient Greek mythology? I guess in a way he's like a messenger, like Hermes or something.
Mm.
We see a lot of these, it's beautiful, actually, these cultural heroes who risk their lives and their reputations to kind of open the secrets, you know, to of the governments, these institutions. And Yeah, I don't know how else to really answer that. But
yeah, no, that's a great one. I was thinking Hades, but Hermes is much better. Again, it depends on, you know, where you are and which side you are with him. I mean, he's pissed off a lot of governments, but well, now there is more that you see, and you call yourself some pretty interesting nomenclature. You call yourself a psychedelic anarchist and a mystic. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that, as I said, I shifted from secular, skeptical scientific materialism to, you know, going through the shamanic experiences and initiation experiences and so on, to recognizing that, like, the physical world and the psychic world are deeply interrelated, you know, much as Carl Jung talks about, you know, that there's kind of this larger field of the psyche, you know, or, you know, if you look at, Tibetan Buddhism, you know, or Eastern philosophy, it's actually the idea that there's maybe just, you know, one consciousness that underlies everything, that fragments itself into all these kind of separate characters, separate individualities and identities, so that it can explore its own infinite creative capacity, its own creative potential, and so on. So yeah, so that's kind of how I look at our situation, and I think that we're, you know, we went from that initial unity. You know, we, for whatever reason, were the sparks of consciousness that wanted to descend, to go through this evolutionary process back into kind of, a new state of unity, you know, that's based on individual sovereignty and autonomy, but also interdependence and symbiosis. And I think that, you know, of the various kind of political philosophies out there, you know, and they're all just words, and, you know, words are just what they are. I like a lot of ideas around anarchism, and a number of other really interesting thinkers have been coming to the realization that anarchism, in a way, is a very useful philosophy for us to look at right now. I just did a talk the other day with this guy, Karn Ross, who was a British diplomat who left the Foreign Service after the Iraq War when he was kind of horrified by, you know, what he saw then. And he just recently wrote a book called The Leaderless Revolution, where he essentially argues that, that governments can't really solve the types of problems that we're facing on the planet right now, and we need a leaderless revolution that for him would be a form of anarchism.
Leaderless revolution. Okay. Anarchism. I wonder what that really means on the ground.
It's kind of, the idea would be, you know, cooperative structures that are sort of fluid, you know, part of the problem now is that, culture is part of the problem. Institutions are part of the problem. You know, like, we become invested in culture, in belief, and we create institutions that then require kind of structures of authority, leadership. You know, they have their own inertia, their own momentum, and we get locked into these kind of cultural forms that we've constructed. You know, anarchism would really be recognizing that all of that, you know, is just part of the effluvia, really, that ultimately nature is, you know, fractal, based on constant movement, constant change, constant transformation. So it would be more kind of creating a, kind of an interdependent mesh of cooperative structures that work together fluidly and are able to evolve rapidly.
Great. Well, hold it right there. We're just coming up to a break, and I want to invite people to start calling in. We'll take some questions because we want to get as many different opinions and thoughts in here as we can while we have the time. We're talking with Daniel Pinchbeck, and he's the author of the book, Breaking Open the Head, A Psychedelic Journey into the Heart of Contemporary Shamanism in 2012. And, of course, he's a writer, author, written for Rolling Stone, Esquire, and many other top magazines. And I want to hear your questions after the break. My name is Rob Simone, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Yeah, welcome back to Coast to Coast AM. Now, we're talking with Daniel Pinchbeck about many things, including his new think tank, the Center for Planetary Culture, and what this world will look like after it makes its transition to a post-carbon civilization and everything that entails and what's driving it. And I want your questions too. We're going to jump right into it because the phones are just literally exploding off the hook. And when we come back, let's try and first tackle this idea that Daniel was alluding to about this collective mind. And I wonder what he thinks about the 100th monkey, you know, paradigm, where when enough people know something, everybody knows it. And I wonder his thoughts on how much we're connected. And we're going to find out right after this break. Stay right there. Welcome back to Coast AM. Our guest is Daniel Pinchbeck. His websites and his books are all linked up right now at coasttocoastam.com. And Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, well, thanks for hanging in there. There's a lot of people, obviously, that want to talk to you, and I thought I'd start the phones a little bit earlier to take a little bit pressure off your voice there. But I wonder about this idea that we're all connected by this field of mind. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it's, I really like Friedhof Capra's book, The Tao of Physics, and, you know, kind of the whole theory that, you know, somehow like the developments in quantum physics, you know, action at a distance, all the stuff that they learned really supports this idea that somehow consciousness is kind of, matter, consciousness, and energy, in a sense, we could say, are three forms of one interdependent thing, you know? And in a sense, consciousness would be the underlying factor. So on some level, yeah, we're all connected. You know, we've always been connected. We always will be connected. As I said, maybe we're going through this process of differentiation and individuation so that we can, you know, re-attain a state of unity, a state of interdependence, but at a higher octave of being and knowing. You know, there's the possibility, for instance, that our technology and science could reintegrate with nature. You know, if we look at, we can look at nature as perfected technology. I mean, one of the things that I think we're going to definitely have to look at in terms of the future is the cradle-to-cradle technology. It's this idea that William McDonoghue developed that essentially all of our industrial processes could be redesigned so that all of the effluents fed back naturally and even positively into the ecosystems, which is obviously what happens with nature, right? Nature doesn't create any waste. You know, it's just us in these last few centuries of transition and development have been creating waste. You know, so I think we could look at a possibility that we create technologies in the future that are just almost like a higher order aspect of nature, you know, in that they feed back effortlessly and seamlessly into the natural environment.
Hmm. There's been amazing advancements in quantum mechanics, and we recently found the Higgs particle in this Higgs field that stretches to infinity that supposedly these things come out of, and these virtual particles. I mean, we're beginning to unlock the fabric of the universe. What does that say about us? Do you think that the revelations that are coming out of this quantum world are going to drastically impact how people relate to it and relate to themselves and each other?
I think that, you know, we've already had enough kind of developments in that respect that kind of our, you know, kind of, you know, our language-based culture is still struggling to catch up, you know, with what we've already understood from quantum physics, whether it's like relativity. I mean, we still act very much as if we're in a Newtonian reality. One thing that really fascinates me is if we were to really understand that consciousness is maybe this underlying, you know, factor, and that, you know, potentially a lot of the, you know, as I said, I personally experienced a lot of psychic, you know, psychokinetic, telepathic kind of experiences through shamanism and with shamans and so on. Like, and a lot of these ancient cultures around the world really, really knew all this stuff to be true. In my book, 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl, for instance, I talked about the Hopi in Arizona and how, this Cambridge anthropologist spent years with them and had to admit, I mean, he was a skeptic and an empiricist, but he had to admit that there were things about the culture that were very numinous and extraordinary. And one aspect of it was he would find that he would go to these rain dances, Kachina dances, and sometimes, not always, but sometimes would almost be miraculous. They would dance for 20 or 30 minutes in a blazing hot sun desert day, and clouds would gather and rain would fall. And this is, I think, corroborated by, you know, evidence from a lot of cultures around the planet that, you know, we may have an electromagnetic relationship to our environment, and even on a deeper level, and maybe that things are possible that we simply don't conceive yet. Our science isn't big enough or isn't expanded enough to really conceive of what's possible. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, You know, I sometimes think that we're pushing ourselves towards this brink as a species to access these latent capacities, these psychic and paranormal aspects of our psyche that we could actually learn to, you know, use technically to to bring our Earth back into balance, you know, to bring human society back into balance with the needs of the planetary ecology.
Mm, great. Well, let's bring in some other questions. We have Natalie on the west of the Rockies line in San Diego. Welcome to Coast AM.
Hi, guys. Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
I would just like to ask you what you think your opinion is on the fact that Generation Y, I'm 25 years old right now. I just feel like our generation might be a major lacking tool or factor, you could say, in the advancing of this country. What are your opinions or thoughts on the fact that our generation is a little bit blinded towards major issues right now?
Yeah, totally. Well, you know, we're all trapped in this culture of like, distraction. And yeah, the younger people have definitely been immersed in kind of video games, media, and then kind of a lot of this indoctrination. I mean, I would look at violent video games as a form of indoctrination. They help to, in violent television and films in the same way, they help to kind of normativize us to an idea that human culture is inherently violent, right? I think this has deeply negative impacts. You know, if we were to create a culture that promoted the positive and altruistic aspects of human behavior, you know, that would also be reinforced, you know, for young and old people. I really wouldn't count, you know, Generation Y or Z out at this point. I think that, you know, as I said, when I tour around and I go to these transformational festivals or all these experiences I have with younger people, I'm often totally blown away by how genius they are and how much they're excited, you know, and inspired. You know, what I've been trying to kind of convey, we were talking before about mythology, you know, one way to look at our situation is almost like, you know, a great adventure, like Lord of the Rings or, you know, the Mission Impossible or the Matrix or something. You know, we could look at ourselves on a hero's journey right now, both as a species and individually. And, you know, individually, like, we have to reckon with the fact that nobody's going to make these changes for us. You know, there's no authority system, there's no expert, there's no corporation or government that's going to make the requisite level of change that has to happen to protect our future as a species. So it's up to us individually to take back our power and realize that we're the ones who must make the change that we want to see in the world.
Mm, very good. You know, sometimes it doesn't feel like this is a hero's journey. It feels more like we're in an experiment. What would happen, you know, like in Northern Ireland, if you surround a city with turrets and soldiers? What would happen if you, you know, gather everybody's data and put cameras everywhere like they do in the UK? What would happen if you, you know, bombard people with, these messages? Doesn't it feel more like we're in some grand experiment?
Well, I mean, that's in a weird way, that's sort of deep metaphysical and philosophical question. I mean, I really like, for instance, Nick Bostrom is a transhumanist philosopher, and a number of philosophers are now looking at the possibility that, you know, material reality, this physical universe itself, could be a simulation running in some, like, you know, supercomputer created by AIs in, like, the future, past, present, no time, you know. So, you know, that's possible. But I think it really comes back once again to more like the Buddhist idea of Maya or illusion, and maybe these kind of infinite dimensions or infinite levels of reality that are almost like an aspect of the imagination expressing itself.
Right.
Maybe that leads us far away from your initial question, but maybe that gives you some sense of how I think about things.
That's all right.
Experiment is one level, but mm-hmm. another level would just be, you know, the process that evolution must take for a species at our level of cognitive capacity and intelligence and creativity, you know, to be put under enough stress to make the requisite jump or metamorphosis to a higher order knowing and a level of knowing and being. Much in the same way, I mean, I really like the metaphor that's often gets used in this you know, kind of area of the metamorphosis of the caterpillar to the butterfly. you know, where it's not as if the caterpillar simply grows wings in the cocoon. It's like the whole body of the caterpillar begins to disintegrate and melt, and a small number of imaginal disks or imaginal cells have that new code for the transition or the transmutation, and they propagate that code and are able really to reorganize the mass of this caterpillar into this next evolutionary form of the butterfly, which shifts the being from kind of a consumer, you know, kind of, you know, just crawling around to a pollinator that's gained the added dimension of flight.
Great metaphor. Let's jump back on the phones. Wildcard line. Jacob is in Wilson, North Carolina. Welcome, Jacob.
Hey. I've been on pretty much this exact same thought process for quite some time now. I think it takes an incredible amount of understanding and acceptance that we really don't know what it is we're working on here. My question is, I think anarchist might be a brutal term, might paint a target on your back. Would naturalist be a better word?
What's a naturalist?
I don't know, just somebody who believes that nature might be the best way. I'm just thinking it might be something along the better lines. I think anarchist just sounds like something that's going to turn a lot of people off.
Yeah, you're probably right. We have these, you know, tendencies to get attached to terms. And I wouldn't get attached. I kind of said it in jest as a psychedelic anarchist. I think we could just really look at, you know, in a sense, you know, the development of symbiotic and corporative, you know, cooperative structures that are more fluid and more based on, you know, direct participation, and potentially a shift also in the tools that we use to exchange value, you know, of which Bitcoin is kind of maybe a first harbinger.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up, Jacob. Let's jump over to St. Louis. We've got Fred on the wildcard line. Welcome to Coast to Coast. You're on with Daniel Pinchbeck.
Hi, Daniel. How are you doing tonight?
Awesome. How are you?
Okay. My question is this. What do you think that the optimal population planet should be? I'm just kind of curious. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks.
Well, I think that, like, first of all, I think the idea of overpopulation is iffy. You know, in actuality, the human species occupies a very small amount of biomass on the planet. You know, apparently you could take the whole human population of 7 billion and they could stand shoulder to shoulder Manhattan Island, or the whole population of the Earth could be moved to Texas and with enough room for people to have, like, little backyard gardens.
When you ride the subway, sometimes it feels that way.
So on the level of biomass, you know, and what our actual needs are, it's not really not that great. It's actually just, you know, this inertia of our industrial, you know, corporate government systems that have evolved based on kind of massive inefficiencies. You know, unfortunately, we live in a system that's basically based on waste, right? Like, we have to keep consuming, you know, to keep these corporations in business, and, you know, they actually, you know, devise things like planned obsolescence, you know? So, like, your sneakers have to go out of whack every 3 weeks. So you have to buy a new pair of sneakers, you know, or your computer becomes unusable after a year or two, so you have to buy another, you know, $1,000 tool. So
you don't see overpopulation as a
overpopulation. Yeah. So I think that there isn't really necessarily a limit. It's really about our use of resources. I really love Alan Watts's idea that you know, the growth of human population is very, you know, in a sense, an organic process. He talks about how, just as an apple tree apples, you know, the apple tree just naturally makes an abundance of apples, the earth peoples, you know, the earth is enjoying making an abundance of people. You know, one way I look at it, I was talking before about this Lynn Margulis idea that maybe part of our destiny is to reach out to these other worlds and bring the living biosphere to other planets. Like, you know, maybe if we're populating, you know, so much, you know, that's eventually part of an exodus, you know, where we go on this great exploration or adventure as a species. You know, of course, from where we are now, that seems unlikely, and we definitely have to bring the whole population up to a much higher standard of education and awareness and so on. But once again, if we look at the, you know, planetary infrastructure of our global communications technologies, there's no reason technically that we couldn't be sharing knowledge and learning universally.
Well, in the first hour, you talked about how the fertility on a mass level has been going down, yet population seems to be going up.
Well, yes, I talked about the sperm count. I mean, we know that it's getting harder for people as they get older to, you know, to get pregnant. But, yeah, I mean, on the other hand, we have a huge surplus of excess energy when it comes to reproduction and fertilization and so on. So, yeah, I mean, at that point, in that sense, yeah, we're still able to keep populating. But, you know, so I mean, if we were to look at our course from where we are now, the likely course over the next 60 to 70 years could very likely be a large-scale reduction in the human population.
Hmm.
If we look at what's happening with climate change accelerating, with, you know, the potential for, you know, the sea level to rise, you know, 80 feet, you know, to swamp, you know, inland and so on. Yeah, I mean, it could get very desperate, and maybe that's what's going to happen. I mean, it may be that, you know, 150 years from now, the population is down to, you know, a few hundred million people or, you know, less living in domed cities in the northern latitudes, you know, but, you know, even there, I mean, that would seem totally traumatic and tragic from our perspective. But in terms of, you know, Earth time or Gaian time, it would just be a blip, you know, a few thousand years. You know, if humanity then had to go to that type of contraction to really learn the lessons that needed to be learned about how to have technologies that are integrated with the planetary ecology and so on, then, you know, we would over 10,000 years, you know, potentially repopulate the Earth and so on. Mm. I mean, that's one possible outcome. It's certainly not the outcome I favor, because I hate the idea of so much suffering and so much death. I would much rather that we reassessed where we are now and actually humanity as a whole made a new kind of social contract that over the next 10 years we were going to make you know, these significant transitions, you know, away from CO2 to, you know, renewables, which are now conquerable in, you know, in every sense, where we could actually be, you know, creating more like decentralized, localized, autonomous systems where people are able to create their own energy and feed it back to the grid, grow their own food, and so on.
Right.
So I think what we need are essentially models, templates for autonomous, self-sufficient community structures, you know, from village to city size, that can then be kind of, kind of shared across the earth.
Mm, right. Well said. Well, a lot of questions for you. Let's go east of the Rockies, Burlington, North Carolina. Welcome, Leslie. You're on with Daniel Pinchbeck.
Well, thank you very much. Do you mind if I ask Daniel, Ron, a question before I, first of all, Daniel, happy birthday. Aren't you 48 today?
I am.
Yeah.
All right. Super. Well, I'm not that much older than you. I'm 53, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to ask you, before I ask you my main question, do you have any brothers and sisters?
No.
Okay, so you were an only child.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and no wonder, well, you're exquisitely intelligent and I'd say brilliant. And I would also say creative in thinking, okay? And at any rate, I wanted to ask you, though, at the beginning of your conversation, you said that, and I took it as our Western civilizations, or I don't know exactly what I took it as, that we don't have any rituals, we don't have places that we go and do drugs, never mind the things that I think that part of, but you have a very good memory, so obviously the drugs that you've done in your life haven't harmed that.
You know what? Hold it right there. We'll get your question in after the break, but we're just coming up to a place where we're going to have to just hold it for just a second. So we'll ever just gather our thoughts. And I'll remind people that you're listening to Coast to Coast AM. This is a great interview with Daniel Pinchbeck. He is giving us all kinds of things to think about. And this one is going to stay with me for a while. I don't know about you guys, but stay right there. We're coming back. More of your questions all in the next hour. My name is Rob Simone. This is Coast to Coast AM.